This episode of the CSEN podcast was recorded on 21st March 2022 by Ola Rummel and Mark McKenzie of the CSEN Center. You can listen to our other episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The title for this session is Sanctions and Crypto Asset. My name is Mark McKenzie. I'm a senior financial sector specialist in the Financial Stability and Supervision and Payments Workstream at the CSEN Center.
And my name is Ole Rummel, and I'm the Director of Macroeconomic and Monetary Policy Management at the CSEN Center.
Ole, we haven't seen each other for a long time. I hope you're well, my friend. But certainly over the past couple of weeks, we've seen and we've heard a number of statements with respect to crypto assets. And this is coming out primarily out of concerns that crypto assets may be used to evade some of the sanctions that we have seen imposed on Russia recently. Over the last 2 weeks, we have heard from the U.S. Treasury's Financial Crime Enforcement Network, FinCEN. They have issued an advisory on the increased vigilance for the potential of Russian sanctions evasion with respect to crypto assets. Last week, or the week before, pardon me, the U.S. President Joe Biden also signed an executive order with respect to risk and benefits of cryptocurrencies and crypto assets. And just last weekend, the authorities in the UK issued a joint statement reminding financial services firms that crypto assets cannot be used to evade economics, can be used to evade economic sanctions, and entities and individuals should pay attention to the crypto asset space. Certainly, Ole, we would love to explore some of these issues. So perhaps, Ole, we will just tell our audience that this coming Friday, we will have a session on a webinar on AML sanctions and crypto assets, which a number of our colleagues, including Mr. Glenn Tasky and Iso Sungor from the Financial Center and yourself, Ole. So, Ole, what can you tell us about sanctions?
Yeah, thank you, Mark. So this, if I can just add to this, this session is meant to be a teaser for Friday's online seminar. We're going to raise a number of issues without providing definitive answers to a lot of the issues we will raise. We will try and do that on Friday. So this is meant to be a teaser where we tee off some of the issues and some of the open questions and provide our listeners with some food for thought. And then hopefully we will see as many of you on our online seminar on Friday. So the history of sanctions is actually quite interesting, especially when we think about the current conflict, because sanctions were first created 100 years ago. They were created in the early 20th century and were mainly used by European countries in an effort to deter nations from going to war again after World War I. So this was sanctions were used as an alternative to military interventions in the period between World War I and World War II. And again, on the European continent, where 100 years later, we are seeing the invasion of Ukraine. The sanctions are considered a useful foreign policy tool and as an alternative to war. They are restrictive measures intended to be temporary that can be used to force a change in behavior, constrain a country's actions, or to communicate a political message to other countries and individuals. We shouldn't forget that, sanctions have become probably one of the most widely used foreign policy tools in the post-war era. That being said, we shouldn't forget that the history of sanctions shows that they affect both those countries on which sanctions have been imposed and the countries imposing the sanctions. So there is a spillover back, or there's a potential spillover back from the affected country to the countries imposing the sanctions.
Alay, so before we get into some of the unintentional consequences of sanction, can I just share, because I'm not a sanction expert, but my understanding is that there are two types of way to look at sanctions. The primary sanction, which is a lot of what you have just spoken about. And then there is this issue of secondary sanctions as well.
Indeed.
Which, if I may, in this case of Russia, for example, the US, the EU have imposed sanctions, and there is this notion that there are countries that have not imposed sanctions, but some of these sanctions could be impact these countries that have not imposed sanctions, and these are called secondary sanctions. So perhaps, Ole, before we get to that, would you like to share for our audience what types of assets or what can be sanctioned, that is?
Indeed, I will do that in a second. Let me just sort of briefly tell you what the academic literature has identified as key conditions for economic sanctions to work. And there are a handful of them. You can probably think of more preconditions or more key conditions, but let me just five which I've come across. The first one is that we should aim for major immediate damage to the country, to the target country. So keep that in mind when we talk about the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia, whether this is actually the policy that has been followed. The second key condition is that we should seek cooperation from other countries and international organizations. The third one is that we should expect autocratic regimes to resist foreign pressure more often than democracies. The fourth one is that consider that rivals are more defiant against sanctions than allies. And the final one is that sanctions are less effective in achieving major policy objectives than modest ones. So I think this is what we should keep in mind when we think about what sanctions have been imposed on Russia and in what severity. But I think, Mark, you know more about the actual sanctions that have been imposed on Russia than me.
You're being kind to me, my friend. Certainly, in terms of the sanctions that I have read about, because I'm not going to sit here and profess to be an expert on sanction, I think we could classify them in three groups. The sanctions have been imposed on individuals as well as on economic sectors, for example, the oil and gas sector, and as well as I'm aware that there are some financial measures as well. So I know that, for example, the some prominent people from Russia, some of whom they're classified as oligarchs, have been sanctioned. We know that there are people within the political structure of Russia, including the president and his finance minister, who have had their assets frozen. We know recently as well that the oil and gas sector, there is a ban on purchase of oil and gas from Russia, certainly by the US quite recently. But perhaps the most, and you mentioned the impact as one of the criteria for the effectiveness of sanctions. So perhaps the most impactful, certainly from where I sit, has been the financial measures. For example, with the assets of the Russian Central Bank, the Central Bank of Russia's Russian Federation has been frozen. Some 630 billion in foreign reserve have just been frozen by Western economies. We're also aware that other entities, prominent entities in Russia, have had their assets frozen as well. And of course, the big one, which we'll perhaps talk more about on Friday, is the removal of Russian banks from the SWIFT network. So certainly, in my experience as a financial stability specialist, it is perhaps some of the most severe sanctions that I've seen imposed, Ali.
Yeah, so I think this is the appropriate time to pick up your earlier question to me in terms of what assets are sanctionable, if that word exists. And I drew up a little list starting with what you also already touched upon, which are Russia's foreign exchange reserves. The next item on my list would be commodities. Such as gold, energy, i.e. oil and gas. And Russia has some other commodities, some rare earths and some metals, and I think some grains and wheat as well. So what we found, and this really is to me as a macroeconomist, this to me is really the most impactful and the most staggering so far, which is the seizure of a large part of Russia's foreign exchange reserves. And this is probably unprecedented and unheard of in the post-war era. Now, we shouldn't forget that Russia has been sanctioned since 2014, i.e. since the annexation of Crimea in 2014. But I think the speed and the scope of the sanctioning of the Central Bank of Russia or the Bank of Russia is unprecedented. I mean, you will hear this word a lot in the context of the sanctions, but it probably really is the case. Because if you think about it, here we have a central bank. To begin with, we have a central bank. It's not a commercial bank. It's a central bank, and it's a central bank of a G20 nation. And it's a central bank that has been that has performed a very credible and very reputable function despite the regime that it serves. It's been a well-regarded and well-run central bank. And yet, the international community or parts of the international community have probably for the first time ever taken it upon themselves to seize or to immobilize a large part of the foreign exchange reserves. And we need to see how this will be perceived and what the sort of longer term consequences of this what the longer term consequences of this are.
Yeah, I think that's you're making a very good point on the removal of Russia from the global financial system, Uli. I know you're going to get at some of the unintended consequences, but given that you were speaking about what assets can be sanctioned, a large part of what we have heard over the last 2 weeks is the prospect that crypto assets could be used to circumvent the sanctions. And I found myself over the last 2 weeks, Oli, wondering if I should be more concerned about other risk of crypto assets than its ability to evade sanctions. So Ole, perhaps you could help us out here in, can crypto assets be used, can they be used to evade sanctions?
I think it's very hard, if not impossible, to use crypto assets or cryptocurrencies for this purpose. And let's think about it in terms of, there are two conversations going on about Russia's use of digital currencies for sanctions. The first one is about commercial or private cryptocurrencies, i.e. the likes of Bitcoin, Tether, Ripple, I mean, you name it, all this sort of household cryptocurrencies that exist, you know, part of these 10,000 different cryptocurrencies that exist. The second issue here, though, the second conversation is about the potential use of a central bank digital currency, i.e. A CBDC. Now, I think it's not feasible for either of those two to be of any help in terms of evading Russian sanctions. And there's a lot of chatter about this. And let me just sort of give you sort of my quick thoughts on how and why this may not work. First point to raise is, we tend to forget that cryptocurrencies are not as anonymous as people make them out to be. And indeed, crypto exchanges, i.e. the entities that convert from a real currency, say the US dollar or the euro or whatever, into a cryptocurrency and vice versa, have become much more aware of the anti-money laundering, the AML, or know your customer, the KYC regulations that you have mentioned. So all US-based cryptocurrency exchange platforms will have to comply with the US sanctions and block the wallets of Russian individuals targeted by sanctions. We also know that, we've also found out that cryptocurrencies have tracking features which make their illicit use much easier to find and punish. And you may have listened to one of Mark's earlier Friday morning Kaffee Klatsch meetings. In September of 2021, in terms of the ransom attack on whatever pipeline it was in the US.
Hololens pipeline, yeah.
US authorities have been able to recover a large part of that ransom payment. Cryptocurrencies are not as anonymous and not cannot be hidden as easily as people say. So I think cryptocurrencies, private cryptocurrencies, are not feasible. Well, what about CBDCs? Well, Russia has started work on a CBDC 2 weeks ago. So the Russian CBDC is nowhere close to being a feasible CBDC, because these things take years to design and create. What I also should have said, the estimates I saw how much money the Bank of Russia would need is about $400 billion to counteract the sanctions that target the foreign reserves.
And obviously, Ole, the crypto asset space is not that large.
Indeed.
As well as it lacks the liquidity in terms of to be able to support an economy the size of Russia. Ole, I take your point. Just to flag for the benefit of our audience that, you know, in the last couple of years, we have seen a lot of cyber attacks, especially from the North Koreans and the Lazarus Group. They have actually used crypto assets as a means to mask the trail of thefts that has taken place in the crypto space. And they have two main techniques that they use, the peel chain techniques and the chain hopping technique. That they use to help mask the trail of crypto assets that have been stolen or financial assets that have been stolen. Ole, I know we're running out of time. So perhaps, Ole, if we could end on the highlights in terms of you mentioned earlier the unintended consequences of sanctions, and then perhaps if you could circle back for us, Ole, some of the other risks that we should be concerned about with respect to crypto assets.
Yeah, let me just having rubbished cryptocurrencies in this respect, I should point out that on a positive note, cryptocurrencies are actually helping one of the two warring parties. And Ukraine over the last couple of weeks has received about $106 million in crypto assets that people have donated to the people of Ukraine in terms of the war effort. So this is a positive positive implementation of cryptocurrencies. I don't think physical donations would have been as quick and as efficient in terms of being sent to a war-torn country than a cryptocurrency. And these donations are used for helmets and medicine and hospitals. So they they're not being used to buy weapons and guns and whatever else. But they finance the war, fallout from the war. I think in terms of some of the lessons, some of the implications, one is that pretty much every asset can be sanctioned now. I mentioned this a little bit. We've seen the foreign exchange reserves being sanctioned. We've seen Russia is also a big holder of gold. Gold has some advantages over other assets, but one of which is that it's a bearer instrument. So unlike a US dollar, it can't be frozen at the click of a button, but it can still be stopped by what you described a little bit earlier, these secondary sanctions. So this is where these secondary sanctions come in, i.e. You sanction, you know, this is a case of a friend of my enemy is my enemy. So you sanction countries that support the target of the sanctions.
So I guess the point there, Ole, is that sanction is can be extraterritorial in the sense that if country A is sanctioned and country B, but if country A is sanctioned by country C, and country C does not impose any sanctions on country A, then entities in country B could invariably be caught in the secondary sanctions.
Absolutely. I couldn't have explained that any better.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, I'm learning a bit or two about sanctions, Ole. But Ole, again, just to be mindful of our time. So how worried should we in Western societies be in terms of some of the sanctions that have been imposed? I mean, are we going to be paying more for oil and gas? What are the consequences for people in Western society? And, you know, in terms of the financial stability risk of crypto asset, should we be worried about the rate at which crypto assets are growing from a financial stability point of view?
I mean, there is one reason why I find this topic so interesting is because there's so many things to think about, so many potential things to think about, so many things we haven't had the time today to talk about, but hopefully we'll be able to talk about on Friday. So let me just highlight one thing, well, one topic which I find very, very interesting is this idea of whatever you want to call it, of Fortress Russia. So Russia over the last 8 years has tried to extricate itself from the international financial system. And we've seen that this is not really all that easy. So this idea that you can have financial autarky from the rest of the world, they've tried it. They've tried to de-dollarize. So this is another fascinating topic. To what extent can you de-dollarize, i.e. make your economy less dependent on the US dollar? And we may want to talk about this a little bit on Friday. Another topic that sort of interests me, and in terms of these unintended consequences, is what I mentioned at the very beginning, this idea that a central bank, that a reputable central bank of a G20 nation can be sanctioned. And this has implications for foreign reserves holding. Where do you hold your reserves? It used to be the case that the reserves are being held in the issuing country of the currency. Is that for countries that have built up large foreign exchange reserves, is this tenable anymore? Or would you want to remove your foreign currency reserves into jurisdictions or that are less prone to sanctions? What about this whole idea, this textbook idea that I have been teaching in some of my events, that since the Asian crisis of 98-99, several countries have built up incredibly large foreign exchange reserves, which have, on occasion, helped them during a crisis. Well, if these reserves can be taken away from you, what does that mean for managing, for preventing, and then managing a crisis, a capital flows crisis going forward, for example? What about holdings of U.S. treasuries or of high quality assets? There's some very interesting analysis I've seen of Russia moving their holdings of treasuries to Belgium and the Cayman Islands, i.e. more out of reach of the U.S. authorities. So there's a number of topics we can talk about, including crypto, cryptocurrencies,
Yes. And I think to get the answers or some of the answers that we are probing and contemplating here at the CSUN Center, Ole, we have to invite our audience to join us for our online seminar on Friday to hear what are some of our thoughts on some of these subjects. Certainly, Ole, I am intrigued. I have been intrigued over the last 3 to 4 weeks by this topic, and I think we will have a lot to learn and a lot to share with our member institutions over the next couple of months and coming years in terms of economic stability and financial stability. I mean, Ole, I think I have to leave it there because there's just so much for us to discuss on this subject.
Indeed. And let me just conclude by saying that we shouldn't forget that this is a humanitarian tragedy as well. So, you know, it's while I have been very intrigued by many of these topics, and while I have been happy thinking about the issues that have been raised, we shouldn't forget that there is a war going on European soil with casualties on both sides, including civilians. So this is this should always be in the back of our minds as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. So thanks everyone for joining us for this special CSUN Center podcast. Ole, it's certainly a pleasure to be back on air with you.
Likewise.
I hope we'll do a couple more on some of these topics as well. Certainly a pleasure. Thanks everyone for listening.
Yeah, thanks, and stay safe and stay healthy.
Bye-bye.